We pick up today in 1 Kings chapter 14, the last of our section on Jeroboam, and I know many of you must think I've learned everything about Jeroboam that I want to know, but we dive once more into good old Jeroboam, who is the worthless king of worthless kings, a man who was promised a kingdom that God would work in if he would but follow, and he did not. He was promised that if he would walk with God, God would work with him. And he wouldn't walk with God. And so we are gaining lessons from such things, that we not be ignorant, but also living in the light, as I have cautioned you before, we live on the backside of the cross, that the cross purchases a great deal more tolerance from God and a great deal more patience in his working than perhaps we see in the age of law in the Old Testament. But we pick up here in verse 1 of chapter 14. At that time, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, became sick. Jeroboam said to his wife, "Arise now, disguise yourself, so that they will not know you are the wife of Jeroboam. Go to Shiloh. Behold, Ahijah the prophet is there. He's the one who spoke concerning me that I would be king over this people. Take 10 loaves with you, some cakes, a jar of honey, and go to him. He will tell you what will happen to the boy." Now Jeroboam's wife did so and arose and went to Shiloh, came to the house of Ahijah. Ahijah could not see, for his eyes were dim because of his age. Now the Lord had spoken to Ahijah, "Behold, the wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire of you concerning her son, for he is sick. You shall say thus and thus to her. For it shall be, when she arrives, she will pretend to be another woman." When Ahijah heard the sound of her feet coming to the doorway, he said, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam, why do you pretend to be another woman? For I am sent to you with a harsh message. Go say to Jeroboam, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people, tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commands and who followed me with all his heart to do only that which is right in my sight. You have also done more evil than all who were before you and have gone and made for yourself other gods and molten images to provoke me to anger and hath cast me behind your back." We stop there for a moment. Now, you understand the scenario. It's perfectly understandable. Is that Jeroboam is concerned over his son. We don't know how old his son is, but we would theorize or estimate that he must be older than a child, but he is ostensibly and assuredly the next in line to the throne, that he would be the succeeder to Jeroboam, and he's become ill. And as is the case with the altar, that in a moment of crisis, Jeroboam would reach out to the God, to God of Israel, to God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but not unless he had to. And this is the thing that we go back to when we wonder, how in the world can a guy who's seen God do these things, who used Ahijah years ago demonstrably to give him a prophecy that he would be king, in fact, to deliver it in a sign of 10 pieces of clothing or 10 pieces of cloth, God delivered him a sign, and Jeroboam has no allegiance. And I want you to understand, that is simply the dynamic of people, that unless God turned their eyes on, they will not see. Unless God calls them to believe, they will not believe. It doesn't matter how many miracles they see. It doesn't matter how many things they see. And I want you to understand that, not only to give you a bit of caution, but also to give you hope. Many of you pray for unsaved loved ones. You wonder, hey, what's going to happen to my son? What's going to happen to my daughter? What's going to happen to my mom or my dad? You know, and you become burdened for them, and you pray for them, and you seek God's will in their life, and you hope that someday they'll open their eyes. But just understand, unless God does a thing, they won't. And you may be somewhat discouraged by that. Well, I just want to caution you. We're just waiting on seeing what God will do. But also understand this, that if God is moving in their life, God is moving in their life, it's going to happen. And don't sweat it. Learn to trust God. And folks, this is always the challenge of the Christian life. Learning to trust God in the areas where we have no operational control. In fact, the more aware that we are that we have no control over a situation, the harder it is to trust God. Because while you're kind of, you know, playing lip service to the idea of trusting God, there's always this stuff you can do, and you try and hurry things along, you know. You try and work through a thing. I've learned this in my own life that, you know, when you do a job at home, you have to, I've come to the, this may be irrational, right? Maybe, but I've come to the conclusion you have to pay your dues. You know, when you're doing a job at home, some part of it can't go right. Right? You ever have this happen where it seems like such a simple idea, I'm going to go do this thing, and you start down doing this thing, and then it goes sideways in a hurry, right? Well, after, I don't know, maybe 2,000 of these events, I started to notice a pattern. I'm a slow learner. And I look at a job now as, you know what, at some point in this job, I'm going to have to pay my dues. When I'm working on the car, something's not going to go right. It's just the way it is. And you just sort of have to, you have to relinquish trying to control all those pieces and just let the thing be. It's a lesson that I continually have to remind myself, and that's because I'm in continual need to remind myself. I become so frustrated with the mechanical world not working the way it ought to. And so you just have to understand this is a part of life, walking through these things, letting the thing be. And that's incredibly hard for me. The truth is, I had to face reality a couple of years ago. I am a control freak. Did I have some sort of reputation that preceded me? But I do. I love to control things. And so when I can't, man, it just, blood pressure just goes through the roof. I'm like, ah! You know? Especially in the mechanical world. You put a bolt in the hole you just took it out of, and for some reason it won't go in. And you're like, we live in the same universe as we did 5 minutes ago. Why won't this? And learn to relax. Learn to trust. And that wasn't Jeroboam's nature. The fact is, part of what's pushing Jeroboam, remember, is fear. Fear of losing his position. Fear after wanting to be king. After wanting to be king more than anything in the world, now that he is king, he's consumed by fear. And so how do I control, how do I manipulate this nation? How do I control these people into safety, into places of safety, where my kingdom is secured, where my position is secured? And he starts moving in directions that he knows are lies, but he commits to the lie. And now that he's committed to the lie, and he's walked into false worship, he's walked into setting up a religion he knows is not true. It's a religion that's in opposition to what he has seen God do and what he has heard God say. And so now he's sitting here with a circumstance that is out of his control, and he has too much pride and too much commitment to the lie to walk backwards. So instead of going to Ahijah the prophet in embarrassment and repentance, he does what many men do. He sends his wife. And I've heard this story. You know, you're driving around, you're lost. Guys rather famously don't want to ask for directions. The reason we don't want to ask for directions is because we know there's an 85% chance that the directions we receive are going to be wrong. 85%. You can't argue with that. I just made it up, see? Actually, when I was a kid, I remember a guy stopping and asking me for directions. And as he drove away, I realized the wrong ones. It still bothers me. So he sends his wife, and his wife in disguise, his wife looking for what will happen. God's there before him. Of course. God tells Ahijah, here's the deal. Jeroboam's sending his wife. He doesn't have the humility to do this himself. And I'm telling you, you are going to deliver a harsh message. And here's the harsh message. Jeroboam, I tore the kingdom out of David's hands. I wrestled it from him. I ripped it from his grasp. As Solomon stepped into error, as Rehoboam continued that error, I took 10 tribes from the 12, and I handed them to you, and you have done with them wickedly. You've done everything wrong. And actually, he ends that speech with this statement, you have cast me behind your back. This is a particularly hard construction in the Hebrew. It's the idea of forcibly, Jeroboam has in essence taken God in both hands and has thrown him. That's the idea. You have cast me behind your back. It's also the image of someone who wants a thing and so they shove someone out of the way. God says, Jeroboam, that's what you've done to me. That's how you've treated me. Instead of acknowledging who I am as God and dealing with me there, you went out and made your own gods. And not only did you make your own gods, but you set up Israel to walk in that path. And yes, they committed to the lie, just as you did. But you have sacrificed orthodoxy to the gods of convenience and the gods of expediency. And Christians, we live there. We live in an age of exactly that. Whatever barrier is in the way, whatever barrier is perceived by our culture to the way that they want to live, they simply shove it out of the way and keep moving forward. That's where we are as a culture. And in fact, the shoving aside of such barriers is considered noble. And it is considered now man's mastery of his own destiny. This is ultimately at the heart of what is, to many of us, a bold-faced, inexorable truth. And although it does involve a minority of people, it involves a majority of culture. And that is this, that a woman can declare herself a man, and a man can declare himself a woman. And it's just not true. It's bold-facedly not true. And in fact, Harvard is now arguing that your sexuality is so fluid that it can change from day to day. That's not true. It's just not. But that barrier of reality is shoved out of the way so that we can get to where we want to go. Folks, that is sacrificing orthodoxy, what's real, to the gods of convenience and the gods of expediency. It's where we are. And God says to Jeroboam, you have forcibly cast me aside. Verse 10, therefore, behold, I am bringing calamity on the house of Jeroboam, and I will cut off from Jeroboam every male person, both bound and free, in Israel. And I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam as one sweeps away dung until it's all gone. Now, I want to translate that word. That's the word poop. Hopefully it's not too technical. You know, let's say you walk in your house this afternoon. I don't want to gross you out. I don't want to bring wicked images in. But let's say you walk in your house and somebody has led in a herd of horses. I guess you can call them herd. And there's all the mess of horses all through your house. And so you say, well, let's get these horses out of here, and then we'll start cleaning up. And so all the horses are out, and all the horse stuff's there. And you go, well, where do we walk? Where do we walk most often? And so you get a push broom, and you push out that section, make sure your traffic patterns are good, and then you leave everything else where it is. Would you do that? You know, this is one of those things. It's one of the reasons that God borrows this image. Paints this. Nobody looks at poop and says, well, that's clean enough. Nobody does that. Have you noticed? Now, you have people coming over and you're in a hurry, so you give the house a quick sweep. You know there's stuff in the corners. You know it's not completely clean. Some things get a lick and a promise, right? But not if it was poop. Have you noticed that? People are, on the whole, pretty thorough with that. And I appreciate that. You know? Nobody has ever gone in your house and you know, you've let the dog go in the middle of the the coffee table, and you go, well, excuse that. The dog was just by. You've never done that ever. And this is one of the reasons I don't like animals in my house, because I always feel like I'm very close to their feces as a result. It's just my paranoia, but I just don't like it. I disregard feces. I don't like it. And God says here, you know what, I'm going to make a clean sweep of Jeroboam's house as you would when you're dealing with dung. There's not going to be a part where you go, oh, that's clean enough or that's good enough. No, you're going to get out the bleach and you're going to get out a good strong brush. And after you're done with the brush, you're coming through with a cloth. And you might take out a little sandpaper just to make sure that we've got every atom. And then you're going to bleach it again. God says, that is how thoroughly I'm going to make a clean sweep of Jeroboam's household. Understand, Jeroboam, I am done with you. Now, understand this, Christian, and this is a thing, that we live on the backside of the cross. We live post-cross, and so our relationship with God in the way that He deals with us has changed. God will never leave you nor forsake you. There's never a point in your life where God says, all right, Dorian, you sin too much, I'm done with you. Now, there's a point where God says, Dorian, you've sinned so much, I'm taking you home. That could be. But I know I'm going home to my Father. He's never going to leave me. He's never going to unadopt me. He's never going to reject what He has called His own. But here in Jeroboam, He says, look, I gave you these tribes. I promised if you walk with me, I would work with you. I want you to understand, Jeroboam, you're done. And so sometimes when judgment comes, judgment brings consequences with it that are absolutely certain and absolutely necessary for judgment to have its value. And I want you to notice how that plays out in this book. Verse 11, anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. He who dies in the field, the birds of heavens will eat, for the Lord has spoken it. Now understand what he's saying here. Your children are going to die and be buried like homeless people. Now, there's nothing more robust in the ancient Near East than the death of a king. God says, Jeroboam, I'm going to snatch even that from you. In the ancient Near East, packs of dogs were the scourge of society. In fact, it's oftentimes referred to that Gentiles were referred to as dogs, because they were just packs of these wild animals that would wander around looking to eat whatever they would eat. There was a time in the ancient Near East when you would have to watch your children in the yard to make sure they were not eaten by packs of wild dogs. Things have changed quite a bit, haven't they? Nowadays, dogs are considered, well, they're pampered and actually de-skilled of their ability to do anything harmful for the most part. But in the ancient Near East, these animals would just roam around. And here, he says, you know what? If your children die in the city, it's going to be a pack of dogs that eat them. A wandering pack of dogs through the street is going to eat them. They will not be buried. They will not have a funeral like King Tut. They will not have anything marking their office and who they are. I'm going to so completely remove the house of Jeroboam that your descendants will die as homeless people. And if they die in the field, birds of the heavens will eat them. They will be the food for carrion birds, for the Lord has spoken. Verse 12, now you arise, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, your child will die. Now all Israel will mourn for him and bury him, for he alone of Jeroboam's family will come to the grave, because in him was something good found toward the Lord, the God of Israel, and the house of Jeroboam. Notice what God just said. Your son Ahijah is going to die. And the reason he's going to die is because in him and in him alone was a heart disposed towards the Lord. And many of you may say to that, what? Ahijah dies because he's God's man? Yeah, absolutely. God's judgment on Jeroboam brings the death of his son because his son believes differently than Jeroboam. The judgment brings the consequence. The consequence affects more than the ungodly. That happens all the time. And so that brings us to a statement. One of the Doran rules in incontrovertible rules of life, right? You are going to bear the brunt of another person's sin. It's just truth. In this life, you will constantly be affected by the sins of others. You will constantly have those sins visited upon you. I will bear the brunt of another person's sin. And that's not fair. It really isn't. But fair's stupid. You realize how absolutely wonderful that little truth is? Isn't that wonderful? Someone actually had that made for me on a t-shirt. I will bear the brunt of another person's sin, and that's not fair, but fair is stupid. I wear it all the time. I remember once I was doing marriage counseling with a couple, and the guy was an angry guy, and one of the reasons he was angry was because his wife's behavior constantly made his life inconvenient. Didn't make his life hard, it made it inconvenient. The reason he was angry about that is because he's a selfish jerk. Right? And so I came in for counseling one night and I plopped down in that shirt. And he sat there and stared at me and he said, well, I can see how this is going to go. I said, yeah, you're right. And I said, here's what we're going to talk about tonight. You're a selfish jerk. And that's the reason this is causing you such problems. If you stop being selfish, your problem goes away. No, if she would change. Right. Understand, the God of judgment, the God of justice, means that sometimes His judgment or the natural consequences of sin are going to spill out on your life. Folks, I think that is an absolutely integral truth to get your head around. Because when things happen to us that are not our fault, what's our reaction? I shouldn't have to put up with this. Life shouldn't be shaped like this. Isn't that funny? You're in the middle of a thing and you say, this shouldn't be happening. Well, it is happening. You know, it's like the person who's sitting in a life raft freezing after the Titanic has sunk, and he says, this should not be happening. Okay, it shouldn't be happening, but it is now. And you can sit there and, there's no other word for it, you can sit there and pout about the reality that you're facing, or you can acknowledge, ah, this is what life has given me. This is what God has given me. This is what circumstances are playing out. It will help, I promise, if you will adopt that mindset. When somebody does something wrong and you feel the weight of it in your life or you're having to deal with the consequences of your life, if you will just accept that this is what life is handing you, I promise it will be better than raging that it shouldn't be happening at all. I promise you it will be better. Learn to accept that in this life, you are going to bear the brunt of other people's sin. And it really isn't fair. But it's also the nature of reality. It's also stupid to demand such fairness out of life. That's not the way it works. This life is not for justice. It just isn't. This is a life that is filled with trial and pain and difficulty and also you're dealing with a bunch of sinners who are just as sinful or more so than you are. And so you are constantly going to be bearing in your life the outcomes of other people's silliness, stupidity, and plain out sin. That's the way it is. And so also for Jeroboam's son. We're not talking about an eternal reward being taken away. We're not talking about a loss of productivity in the kingdom someday. We're just talking about here and now. Let's hold these things in perspective. That when God brings judgment on Israel, He's bringing judgment on the nation, He's bringing judgment on its leaders, but He's also bringing judgment on a culture that has walked away from its God, and some people who are good get mixed up in that, and that is life. God will never in eternity lump you with the sinner. In this life, you will feel the weight of it. And this is incredibly apropos because our country is headed in a direction, and the direction it's headed, if all things being equal and all things hold true, the direction the country is headed is going to bring all sorts of nonsense and chaos into your life. Financially, it's going to affect you. Culturally, in the way that you live your life and the acceptance of others, it's going to affect you. It may affect all sorts of things in the shape of your job. It may affect all things in the shape of the economy and the way that you've lived your life up to this point. All of that may happen, and you can sit there and rage about it, or you can sit there and jam your basement full of canned goods waiting for the end, or you can learn to trust the Lord and learn to walk with Him faithfully in the middle of all sorts of stuff when it happens, because the truth is, you are going to bear the brunt of other people's sin. So sure enough, moreover, the Lord will raise up for Himself a king over Israel who will cut off the house of Jeroboam this day and from now on. For the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. And He will uproot Israel from this good land which He gave to their fathers and will scatter them beyond the Euphrates. And that actually happened in 722 B.C. Assyria came and took Israel away, and they were never seen again. Because they have made their Asherim, provoking the Lord to anger, He will give up Israel on account of the sins of Jeroboam which he committed and with which he made Israel to sin. Then Jeroboam's wife arose, departed, and came to Tirzah, and as she was entering the threshold of the house, her child died. All Israel buried him and mourned for him according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken through his servant Ahijah the prophet. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he made war, how he reigned, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. The time that Jeroboam reigned was 22 years, and he slept with his father, and Nadab his son reigned in his place. 22 years of wasted life. Wasted life. Now, Christian, you're going to have to make a decision about your life. You're going to have to make a decision about how you live out whatever remainder of it is yours to have. Do we go all in and live faithfully to the Lord, be changed by Him, be given circumstances that are difficult, learn to adjust to those circumstances, adjust to the brunt of bearing other people's sin, or do we constantly demand and make steps and efforts in trying to control the circumstances around us and thereby eventually equivocating in our faith and walking away from our God? That's the question. And there's a Christian version of that. There is. There's a Christian version of giving up on God and walking away. You won't lose your salvation. You just lose the productivity of your life. There's a Christian version of not making God's things priority. And so sinking into the priorities of the day or the culture around you, of settling for lesser things, of spending your time rather not in worship but in game, rather in investing in God's kingdom but investing in your own, living life as if it is everything outside of God's community that matters rather than God's church, God's community, the people sitting around you. I encourage you, I beg you, I entreat you, invest in this kingdom that's eternal, this kingdom that matters, this kingdom that is best, as if it's the only kingdom to compete for your attention, and so and thereby avoid the trap of this world and what this world wars to own and and for the time being call theirs. That is slowly slipping through their fingers or being taken from them by circumstances. Let's go to prayer. Father, I do just ask that you would bless your people today. Not find ourselves living as people who reject you, but find ourselves rather by intention, by effort, moving towards you, that we make your things most important in our lives, that we invest in the kingdom to come rather than in the here and now, that we live like what we do matters to you, not simply what gets us what we want. And as we come to communion today, help us to commit to that. Help us to place you at the center of our thoughts again, at the focus of our lives, at the intention of your will, that it would become our will, that what moves your heart would become our heart, that engages your mind would engage ours, and live like eternal beings, for that's what you've created us to be. It's in your name we pray. Amen. As those come forward for communion today, we read again from